Chapter 8. Esaradon's Lair. Lyco the Victor. A Vestige. We went into the grounds of the Lang Palace over the wall. There was a harsh stink of ozone from the ruptured shield, and the trimmed fruit trees and larabot hedges of the gardens were singed and smouldering. With Robin and Inchabel, I ran down a flint-chipped path between the servants' wing and the east portico. Flashlights and under-muzzle torches bobbed in the gardens behind us as Haldane led the main force of our troop round to the garden terrace. The house was dead and dark, all power killed by the pulse. The main doors on the east portico lay splintered on the mosaic floor, where the accompanying wave of overpressure from the void collapse had blown them in. All of the windows were smashed holes, too. Photoreceptors and climate controls in the portico's polished blue-wood panels were fused and charred. Smoke and the glow of flames issued from deeper in the palace. We pushed further in, finding dead house staff and inert servitors. A whole suite of staterooms on the first floor was burning, where ornate promethium lamps had been knocked over. We checked the rooms on each side as we progressed. Robin led the way, sweeping his braced las pistol from side to side.
"How long?" Inchabel asked me.
"Until?"
"Until he recovers from the pulse."
I didn't know. There was no telling how badly we'd hurt Esaradon, or how resilient his mind was. We hadn't got long. On the second floor, a flight of ethersite steps brought us up into a grand banqueting hall. The roof, a turtleback of toughened glass, had fallen in, and the psi storms crackled and surged in the sky far above. Every step crunched glass or disturbed debris. There were bodies here, too, the bodies of nobility and servants intermingled. I heard movement and sobbing from an adjoining antechamber. The wretched occupants of the room gasped in terror as our flashlights found them. A handful of survivors from the household, cowering in fear in the dark. Many displayed signs of psychic burns or telekinetic welts.
"Imperial Inquisition," I said firmly but quietly.
"Stay calm.
Where is Esaradon?"
Some flinched or moaned at the sound of the name. A regal dowager in a torn pearlescent gown curled up in the corner and began weeping.
"Quickly, there's little time. Where is he?"
I thought to use my will to spur them into an answer, but their minds had been tortured enough already that night. Even a mild mental probe might kill some of them.
"When the lights went out, he ran towards the west exit,"
said a blood-soaked man, dressed in what I presumed was the uniform of the House Lang bodyguard. "Can you show us?"
"My leg's broken."
"Someone else, then.
Please.
Flua, you go. Flua."
The bodyguard gestured to a terrified page boy crouching behind a column.
"Come on, lad, show us the way," Robin said encouragingly.
The boy got to his feet, his eyes white with fear. I wasn't sure if he was more afraid of Esaradon or the Inquisitors looming over him. A communicating hallway ran from the rear of the banqueting hall west towards the house's private landing platform. Specks of blood and glass twinkled along its tiled floor. I felt what seemed to me a breath of wind on my skin. An exit to the outside, perhaps. Heavy blast shutters were prized open in the entrance to the gloomy loading dock. Past the shadowy shapes of several slumped, dormant cargo servitors stood a main hatchway through which cold exterior light flickered. My weapon raised, I waved Robin and Inchabel round to the right. The page boy cowered back in the doorway. The air quality was changing, as if the atmosphere itself was stiffening and drawing tight, like some great force gathering its breath. Esaradon was recovering, I was certain. Livid green light suddenly bathed the loading dock, a psychometric flare accompanying a burst of savage psionic power. Robin and I staggered, our lungs squeezed and fingers of telekinesis thrusting at our minds. Inchabel cried out as he was bowled over from behind by the page boy, Frua. Dull-eyed and frothing at the mouth, the boy had been reduced in an instant to a mindless puppet. Inchabel fought, but the boy was feral, and despite the interrogator's superior bulk, he was pinned. The pain in my head was intense, but I knew Esaradon must still be way below full strength. I raised the strongest mind shield my abilities were able to conjure and moved forward. There was a sudden grind of servo gears. A large steel paw swung at my head and I dived back. A cargo servitor, its metal carapace caked with verdigris, rose up to its full height of 3 meters and clanked across the deck towards me on squat, hydraulic legs. Plumes of steam squirted from its broad shoulder joints as it pistoned its arms at me again. Hot yellow dots of light burned in the eye sockets of its dented visor. Despite its mechanical appearance, the cargo drone, like all servitors, was built around human organic components. Brain, brainstem, neural network, glands, so a Saradon could control it just like a standard human. It swung at me again and missed. The slicing limb had cut the air with a distinct whistle. It was built like a great simian, squat legs, barrel chest, wide shoulders and long, thick arms. Ideal for hefting heavy cargo items into the belly hold of a lift ship. Ideal for smashing a human body into gory paste. Roban cried out a warning. A second, larger cargo servitor with a long quadruped body was also moving. Its body casing was pitted brown metal, and it had a forklifter assembly where its head should have been, giving it the appearance of a bull. The greased black forks of the lifter lurched at Roban, who fired 6 or 7 shots that dented or bounced off the machine's chassis. I ducked 2 more slow, heavy blows from the ape servitor. We were losing precious time. With every tick of the clock, Esaradon was recovering and becoming more powerful. I put a bolt round into the thickest part of the servitor's body and rocked it back, the gears and pistons of its legs whining as they compensated for the recoil. My power sword was out now, the blade burning. Blessed for me by the Provost of Inks, it was my weapon of choice. My swordsmanship had always been good, but Arianod had instructed me in the Carthen Ulwaila Skrai before her death. Ulwaila Skrai, literally, the genius of sharpness, the Carthen way of the sword. I made a figure of 8 turn, the Gun Fassel, and then a backhand crossgut, the Huin, or reverse form of the Tarnweiler. The stroke was good. The energized blade sliced clean through the servitor's left forearm, sending the massive manipulator paw clattering to the deck. It lurched bodily at me, as if enraged, clawing with its remaining hand and lashing with the fused, smoking end of its recently truncated limb. I made a head-height horizontal parry called the Uisar, and then left and right block strokes, the Ulsar and the Win Ulsar. Sheets of sparks cascaded from each hit against its metal body. I ducked right under the next huge blow, spun round out of the crouch, and came up to face it again, in time to follow through with the Ura Wiley Bai, the devastating diagonal downslash, left to right. My blade edge and tip sawed the servitor's torso plating wide open in an electrical flash. The exchange had given me long enough to mentally identify the seat of the servitor's brainstem component, lit up and glowing in my mind's eye with the psionic power that drove it. It lay deep under the carapace between the collarbones. One more Uisar, and then the Ulkar, the death stroke. Tip first, plunging clean through the bodywork, impaling the organic brain. I rested the crackling blade there for a moment while the yellow dot eyes went out, and then ripped it clear again, sidestepping as the servitor slammed down onto the flooring. "Roban!" I called out, leaping over my dispatched foe. But Roban was dead. The servitor's forks had his limp body impaled through the belly, and it was shaking it as if trying to dislodge him. Inchabel was on his feet, tears streaming down his face as he blasted at the servitor with his autogun. Cursing, I ran forward, raised the power sword with both hands, and swung it down over the servitor's back. I doubt the Carthens, in all their wisdom, have a name in the most hallowed Ulwaya Skrai for an enraged downstroke that severs the backbone and torso of a servitor. Inchabel ran to his dead master as the servitor collapsed, trying to pull the corpse clear. "Later! Later for that!" I said, spiking the command with my will. Inchabel was close to losing his wits to anger and grief, and I needed him. He snatched up his weapon and ran after me. "The page boy?" I asked.
"I had to hit him. I hope he's just unconscious."
We came out into the storm-racked night on the palace landing pad. Psychic lightning splintered the sky above us, and the wind lashed us. There was no one on the pad itself, but a fight was raging on the lawns beyond. I could see 8 figures, some robed, some dressed in the body armor of the interior guard, closing to surround a lone humanoid who crackled and glowed with spectral light. Thorny jags of flame lit out from the cornered figure and dropped one of the guardsmen as we watched. Esaradon. They had Esaradon cornered. Inchabel and I leapt down from the pad, a 3-meter drop onto the wet grass, and ran to join the fray. I could see Asaradon clearly now, despite the rain. A tall, almost naked man with wild black hair and a lean, stringy body, corpuscent, gleaming and sliding around his capering limbs. We were just 10 meters from the edge of the fight when one of the robed figures raised a bulky weapon and blasted at the rogue psyker. A plasma gun. The violet beam, almost too bright to look at, struck Asaradon. In his weakened state, he had no defense against it. He ignited like an incendiary round and burned from head to foot in the middle of the lawn. Lowering our weapons, Inchabel and I walked to join the ring of figures standing around the white-hot pyre. As his robed and hooded acolytes murmured prayers of grace and deliverance, Inquisitor Lyko set down his plasma gun.
"The Emperor will thank you, Lyko," I said.
He glanced round, seeing me for the first time.
"Eisenhorn,"
he nodded. His narrow face was lined and taut, and his blue eyes hooded. He was only about 50 years old, sidereal, a mere youth by inquisitional standards. Young enough for his promising career to survive the way this day's atrocity would tarnish his achievement on Dulcine.
"I do not serve the Emperor for his gratitude. I do it for the glory of the Imperium."
"Quite so," I said. I looked back at the molten heat that had been our quarry. It mattered little to me that I'd made this opportunity for Lyko. He could take the glory. I didn't care. The escape of the Psykers had stolen much of the glory he had received of late. Hunting them down was the only way he could make amends. Planet-wide, there was some sense of rejoicing when it was announced that Lord Commander Helican had survived the carnage unscathed, and that War Master Honorius would live. That announcement came on the 6th day of unrest, by which time the Imperial authorities had begun to reimpose order on the stricken citizens of Thracian Primaris. But it helped. Common folk who assumed themselves to be lost were calmed into believing law was back in the hands of the great and good. Panics died away. Arbites units unleashed their last few suppression raids against the die-hard recidivist looters in the Lohabs. My own spirits were not much lifted. For a start, I was privy to the confidential fact that Lord Commander Helican had actually died, screaming and shitting himself under a crash-diving Imperial Navy lightning on the avenue of the Victor Bellum. A double had been arranged by the Ecclesiarchy and the Helican Senatorum, and that double continued to act in his place until, several years later, he died naturally of old age, and a successor was established in less turbulent circumstances. I could speak of that public deceit now in this private record, but at the time, communicating that secret was a death crime for even the highest lord of the Imperium. I was not about to break that confidence. I am an inquisitor, and I understand how fundamental it is to maintain public order. In addition to fatigue and the pain of my wounds, what darkened my mood was the news about Gideon Ravenor. Now, of course, we all understand what a priceless and brilliant contribution he was to make to Imperial learning, and how that would never have happened if he had not been confined to a life of mental rumination. But back then, in that stinking hospice ward off the Street of Prescience, all I saw was a young man, burned and crippled and physically paralyzed, a brilliant inquisitor, ruined before he could fulfill his potential. Ravenor, in the eyes of some, had been lucky. He had not been amongst the 198 Inquisition personnel, killed outright by the crashing fighter that fell into the Great Triumph beyond the Spacian Gate. He, like 50 others, had been caught on the edge of the explosion and lived. My pupil was barely recognizable, a blood-wet bundle of charred flesh, 100% burns. Blind, deaf, mute, his face so melted that an incision had been made in the fused meat where his mouth should have been, so he could breathe. The loss touched me acutely, the waste even more. Gideon Ravenor had been the greatest, most promising pupil I had ever taught. I stood by his plastic-sheeted cot, listening to the suck and drool of his ventilator and fluid drains, and remembered what Commodus Voke had said in the Arbites Sector House on Blamaside Street.
"I will make amends. I will not rest until every one of these wretches is destroyed and order restored. And then I will not rest until I find who and what was behind it."
Right then, there, for Ravenor's sake, I made that promise to myself, too. At that time I had little idea what that would mean or where it would take me. I returned to the Ocean House at last on what would have been the ninth and final day of the Holy Novena. There was no one to greet me, and the place seemed empty and forlorn. I stalked into my study, poured a too large measure of vintage Amasek, and flopped down into an armchair. It felt like an eternity since I had sat here with Titus Endor, worrying over speculations that seemed now so insignificant and remote. A door opened. From the instant chill in the air, I knew at once it was Bequin.
"We didn't know you'd returned, Gregor."
"Well, I have, Elizabeth."
"So I see.
Are you all right?" I shrugged. "Where is everybody?"
"When the..." She paused, considering her words. "When the tragedy occurred, there was a great public commotion. Yarat and Kersha took the staff into the secure bunkers for safety, and I locked myself away with the distaff in the west wing, waiting, hoping for your call."
"Channels were out?"
"Yes, for 8 days."
"But everyone is safe?"
"Yes."
I leaned out of my chair and looked at her. Her face was pale and drawn from too many nights of fear. "Where's Amos?"
"Outside, with Betancourt, Kersha and Nail. Von Begg's around too. Is it true what we've heard about Gideon?"
"Elizabeth, it's..." She crouched down and put her arms around me. It is difficult for a psyker to be hugged by an untouchable, no matter how long and close their personal history. But her intentions were good, and I tolerated the contact for as long as it seemed polite. When I gently pushed her back, I said, "Send them in. In fact, send everyone in here."
"They won't all fit, Gregor."
"The sea terrace, then. One last time." Sitting or standing around in the lime glow of the sea terrace, the numerous members of my faithful band looked at me expectantly. The place was packed. Yarat had fussed around, bringing out drinks and sweetmeats until I'd pressed a glass of Amasek into her gnarled hands and forced her down into a chair. "I'm closing the Ocean House," I said. There was a murmur. "I'm retaining the lease, but I have little wish to live here anymore. In fact, I have little wish to be on Thracian anymore. Not after this holy novena. There seems no point maintaining a staff here."
"But, sir, the library..."
Sulis said from the back. I held up a finger. "I will take up a contract arrangement with one of the Hive Accommodation Bureau to keep the house in working order with servitors. Who knows? Sometime I might have need of a place here again." I refilled my glass before turning back. "But I wish to move my centre of operations. It's compromised, if nothing else." At that, Yubel Kersha looked into his sit juice uncomfortably. "I wish to relocate the household to the estate on Gudrun. Its environment suits me better than this hive hell. Yarat, you and Kersha will supervise the packing and organization for the move. I would like you to undertake the duties of head of household at the Gudrun estate, if you are willing. I realize you have never been off Thracian." She sat forward, her eyebrows raised, considering this sudden change to her life.
I would be honored to do so, sir," she said.
"I'm pleased. The country air will do you good. The estate is managed by a caretaker staff, so I'll need a good housekeeper and a good chief of house security. Yubel, I'd like you to consider that job."
"Thank you, sir," said Kersha.
"Sulis, we're going to transplant the library permanently to Gudrun. That task is yours, as is the ongoing duty of being my librarian. Can I entrust you with it?"
"Oh, yes. There will be problems, of course. The handling and care of certain shielded texts and..."
"But can I leave it with you?" Sulis waved his frail hands at me in a gesture of excitement that made everyone laugh. "I know this wholesale move will take months to manage and carry out. Anna, I'd like you to supervise and oversee the whole thing." Von Begg looked suddenly awkward.
Of course, Inquisitor."
"This is a weighty task, Interrogator. Are you up to it?"
"Yes, sir."
"Good. I will return to the Gudrun estate no later than 10 months from now. I trust it will be the home I expect. It was a promise I would fail miserably to keep."
"What of the distaff, sir?"
asked Sir Scover. "I want to divide that," I said. "I want 6 of the best distaff members sent to Gudrun to bide there at my wishes. The future of the distaff itself I see as separate from my living arrangements. I have a lease on a spire-top residence on Messina. That will be the new official home of the distaff. Sir Scover, you will supervise the move and establishment of the untouchable school there." She nodded, shocked. Beckwin seemed taken aback. I looked round at the 100+ servants, warriors, and aides crammed into the room. That's it. Until I see you all again, may the God Emperor protect you. I was left alone with Amos, Beckwin, Medea, and Nail. Not for us the chores of moving house, I said.
I had a hunch not, smirked Medea.
For us, two missions.
For us? Asked Beckwin.
Yes, Elizabeth, unless you think you and I are too old for such diversions.
No, I've
been too long at the back of things, too long relying on my capable staff. I yearn for field work.
The last field work we were in nearly got you killed, scolded Beckwin darkly.
Proving that I'm losing my edge, I think.
For shame, muttered Nail with a smile.
So, we're going to have an adventure, all of us. Just the few of us. Remember what those were like, Amos?
Frankly, I'm still not over them, Gregor, but yes.
Elizabeth? Beckwin crossed her arms ill-humouredly.
Oh, I'd just love to come and watch you get killed.
We're all agreed, then, I said. I can't help being deadpan. Gorgon Locke made sure of that. But my delivery was good enough to get Nail and Medea raucous with laughter, and Amos chuckling. Elizabeth Beckwin grinned, despite herself. Two missions, as I said. After this briefing, I'll allow you to recruit a few personnel from the staff. Nail, a fighter or two you can count on. Amos, an astropath we can use without worry. Elizabeth, one or two from the distaff. A maximum of 10 in the party, all told. No more, you understand? Argue it out between yourselves. Don't bring me into it. We leave in 2 days, and I don't want to even hear about any arguments second hand.
So what are the missions?
Asked Medea, lounging back in her padded chair and slipping her long legs over the arm. She took a long swig of her weed wine and added,
You said two, right?
Two. I pushed a stud on a data wand in my hand, and a hololithic screen fogged into life over the table. The words of the message I'd received before the start of the tumult and Thracian were displayed in shimmering letters. Scalpel cuts quickly, eager tongues revealed. Atcadia, by terse. Hound wishes thorn. Thorn should be sharp.
Shit,
cried Nail.
Is that authentic?
Medea asked, looking at me. It is.
God Emperor, he's in trouble. He needs us, Beckwin murmured.
Very probably. Medea, you have to arrange transit for us to Cadia. That's the first port of call.
What's the second? Asked Amos.
The second?
The second mission.
I looked at them all. We all know how serious the Cadian matter is. But I made a vow to Gideon. I want to find out what was behind the outrage here. I want to find it, hunt it out, and punish it. You know, it's funny how things turn out. It was late, and we were devouring a splendid meal Yarat had prepared for us. Nail was telling a devastatingly crude joke to Amos and Medea, and Beckwin and I were talking over the rearrangement of the distaff and the missions ahead. I think she was feeling excited. Like me, she'd been taking a back seat for too long. Kersha came up the terrace, entering the filmy green light.
Sir, you have a visitor.
At this hour, who?
He says his name is Inchebel, sir. Interrogator Nathan Inchebel.
Inchebel was waiting for me in the library. Interrogator, has my staff offered you refreshment?
None needed, sir.
Very well. So to what do I owe this visit? Inchebel, no more than 25, pushed his thick blonde hair out of his eyes and looked at me fiercely.
I am masterless. Robin is dead.
God Emperor rest him. He will be missed.
Sir, do you ever think what it would be like if you died?
The notion stopped me in my tracks. I had, in all honesty, never considered it. No, Inchebel, I haven't.
It's a terrible thing, sir. As Roban's senior acolyte, it falls to me to disperse his staff, his fortune, his knowledge. I'm left to tidy up, as it were. I have to make sense of Robin's estate.
You will not fail in that duty, interrogator, of that I'm sure. He smiled weakly.
Thank you, sir. I had thought to come to you and beg you to take me on. I so very much want to be an inquisitor. My master is dead, and I know that your own interrogator is...
Indeed, I choose my own staff, of course.
Inquisitor Eisenhorn, Begging you to take me on as a driftwood student was not why I came here. As I said, I had to close up Robin's estate. That meant filing and authorizing the Pathologica statement of his death. Inquisitor Roban was killed by a cargo servitor manipulated by a rogue psyker.
Yes?
So to complete the papers, I had to review the death notice of Asaradon so as to establish causal motive.
That is the procedure, I admitted.
The statement was very brief. Isaradon's corpse was burnt from the calves upwards and utterly immolated. As in the incidents of spontaneous human combustion, the relics left by the plasma weapon were little more than the flesh and bones of the feet and ankles, just bare vestiges.
And?
There was no Malleus brand on the ankle flesh.
It... what?
I don't know who Inquisitor Lyco burned on the lawns of the Langhouse, but it wasn't the heretic Isaradon.